Right. Well, good evening. And for those of you who are not normally here, welcome to the LSE. I'm very glad to see such a full room this evening. I know that others have been turned away, so congratulations for coming on time. Justice is its own reward and all of that, or something. We're here this evening to hear a talk about this book, The Road to Somewhere, which has received a great deal of publicity over, in the last couple of weeks, particularly in the last week. And our speaker, who I'm happy to welcome back to the LSE, he's a regular contributor to events here, is David Goodhart. And as I was just saying to David, I'm going to read the dust jacket, because it's rather an elegantly written dust jacket, in fact. So David is the founding editor of Prospect magazine, one of the most distinctive voices on British politics today. He's currently head of Demography, Demography, Immigration and Integration Unit at the think tank Policy Exchange, having previously been director of the centre-left think tank Demos. I think it's fair to say Policy Exchange is mildly on the centre-right, so this is, it shows great even-handedness over time. His previous book, The British Dream, Successes and Failures of Post-War Immigration in 2013, was the runner-up for the Orwell Prize and finalist for the Political Book of the Year Award in the Paddy Power Political Book Awards. David voted Remain in the EU referendum and has been mainly an inactive member of the Labour Party since he was a student, it says. So there. All I would say by way of a couple more words is that we do live in the most interesting of times, not only in Britain, across Europe and in America as well, a time when issues that had lain dormant are now more visible than they once were. Whether you think that's a good idea or a bad idea, they're more visible than they once were. They're less dormant than they once were. And for that reason, having people who put forward views on why things are as they are and then allowing us to debate about them are inherently to be encouraged. And with that in mind, I'd like to invite you to speak.
Well, thank you very much indeed, Tony. Can you hear me? This is in roughly in the right place. As Tony said, I want to thank you very much for inviting me. I want to talk about the book I've just written, which is about the value divides in British society, which have contributed at least to the instability in our politics, the instability that has led to Brexit. I think it's an example of the instability. It's been my honour to present various different versions of the book's thesis, and I do have specially designed for the LSE a 10-word version of the book, trying to explain this instability. I blame the masses, but not in the way that the left-wing LSE professors blame the masses. I blame mass immigration and mass higher education for the current instability in our politics. And I will obviously return to this and explain what I mean by it. But just to give a taster, I think one of the reasons for our instability is that a large part of the political class, and indeed what one might call the educated class, do not have the same approach to group attachments, for want of a better phrase, as a big chunk of our society do, hence the mass immigration. And also, I think a very kind of under-examined aspect of the evolution of British society in the last generation or two is the way in which educational qualifications and indeed cognitive ability more generally have become the absolute gold standard of value for people in our society. And I think we haven't reflected enough on the impact that has on people who don't have, who aren't highly qualified, people who are in the bottom half of the cognitive ability spectrum. There is always going to be 50% of the population in the bottom half of the cognitive ability spectrum. My maths isn't brilliant, but I've grasped that. So hence my my mass higher education point. Anyway, I'll just very briefly outline my the broad thesis of the book, and then I'll speak for about 25 minutes, half an hour or so. I have invented, in order to illustrate the value divides in British society, I've invented this rather colourful couplet called, in which I, the people from anywhere, the people who come from anywhere, and the people from somewhere. Now, what do I mean by that? I mean the people from anywhere are mainly highly educated people, mainly mobile people, people like us, people who actually, particularly in this country, the mobility is particularly a feature of the anywhere highly educated group in this country because of our residential university system, which isn't actually replicated in much of Europe or even in America. Most American college students live at home or live in their hometown anyway. The Ivy League is residential, but much of the rest is not. The anywhere people, as I say, mobile, educated, mainly pretty liberal. They value openness, novelty. They are pretty individualistic, even if they're on the left, and tend to be rather wary of group attachments. The somewhere people, by contrast, are generally less well-educated, more communitarian in instinct, tend to be less mobile. 60% of the British population live within 20 miles of where they lived when they were 14. We're a less mobile society than people often assume. And they do value stability and security and familiarity, and do value many kinds of group attachments. And sort of mirroring my anywhere, somewhere divide, I borrowed from the famous and I think famously dull American sociologist Talcott Parsons. I haven't read very much Talcott Parsons, I must admit, but I remember when I was at university, people who were reading Talcott Parsons were kind of ploughing through these sort of chemistry textbooks in sociology that he wrote. But he did come up with this very useful distinction between people with achieved and ascribed identities. Rather, everybody has an achieved and ascribed identity, but the anywheres tend to have a much higher proportion of their sense of themselves is achieved. So you're, and I think it's a useful and important distinction, because you have an achieved identity, it comes from your achievements, from your, you know, you passed exams when you were young, you went to good university, you have a career, you're reasonably successful relative to your peers, possibly. So your sense of yourself is bound up with your own biography and your own achievements, which means that your sense of yourself is sort of portable. You can kind of live pretty well anywhere. Because it's a sort of internal thing. Whereas if you have an ascribed identity, you're a Scottish farmer, you're a Cornish housewife, your sort of sense of yourself is much more to do with particular places and in your group. So it is therefore more possible, more likely that you'll be discomforted by rapid change. Because this is another of the key differences, that anywhere people usually ride change comfortably, and somewhere people often see change as loss. Now, obviously, these are massive generalizations, many of the kind of critical comments that have come from people who've probably read sort of shorter journalistic summaries of the book have been that obviously this is ludicrously binary. And just stated like that, it is. But I do go into more detail there are lots of subdivisions within the anywhere group, lots of subdivisions within the somewhere group, and indeed I talk about an in-betweener group. But I have invented these categories. I have not invented these value blocks. They are out there in the data, as you academics like to say. You know, I did spend quite a lot of time ploughing through the British Social Attitude surveys and other value and opinion surveys, and these groups do exist. I also ought to say, both of these value blocks and all their subdivisions are completely legitimate. I've been sort of painted as someone who's hostile to you know, my own group, which is anywhere. I'm not. I mean, I think there is a kind of extreme version of anywhere-ness, which has been very arrogant and is partly responsible for the somewhere populist backlash that we're now experiencing. But I'll come on to that later. But obviously, both of these worldviews are, you know, decent, legitimate worldviews. And our problem is how to coexist, how they can coexist happily in the same society. Like I say, I myself have also invented various subdivisions of, I mean, there is a kind of extreme anywhere group who I call the global villagers, probably about, the anywhere group, by the way, is about 20-25% of the population, and the global villager subgroup is about 5%. The in-between group, as I said, is about 25%. The somewheres are about 50%. And there is a kind of hard authoritarian, genuinely xenophobic group at the bottom of the somewheres of about between 5 and 7% too. But there are other variations. Like I say, I invented the labels, but I didn't invent the groups. If you just look at one statistic, I look at dozens and dozens of different takes on this. But if you just take the statistic on mass immigration, 75% of the population think that mass immigration has been too high or much too high. It breaks down absolutely perfectly according to my schema. So about 50% of the population think the immigration has been much too high. They're the somewheres. About 25% think that it has been a little too high. They're the in-betweeners. About 20-25% think that it's either fine as it is or it should be higher. They are slightly eccentric. They're the global village of 5%. And there's a 20% anywhere who think it's about right. There are all sorts of other surveys I've looked at where it kind of breaks down very, you know, very much along these lines too, whether it's to do with national identity and you know, attitudes to openness. This extraordinary opinion, this extraordinary question, survey question that has been asked a few times over recent years about, you know, some people, I think it goes something like, some people say that Britain has changed too fast in recent years, that sometimes it feels like a foreign country and that makes me feel uncomfortable. Do you agree or disagree? 62% of people agree with that, which just seems to me sort of extraordinary and rather shocking, that in a society as rich and successful and basically stable as ours, that so many people can feel so discomforted by everyday life in the country. But that is the number. And I think it's sort of 28-30% say disagree. Only 30% of the population disagree with that. So it's sort of anywheres plus a few in-betweeners. There are many more examples. Why has this happened now? Because, I mean, in a sense, what I'm saying is just sort of obvious. I mean, you know, it's banal in some ways. So why is it affected our politics so much more in the last few years than over the preceding generation or two? I think there are two interlinked reasons for that. One is that the proportion of somewheres has grown very rapidly in the last generation or two, thanks to the expansion of higher education partly, and the general liberalisation of societies as they get richer. And at the same time, politics has shifted towards more socio-cultural concerns. in some ways, I think, eclipsing the more traditional socioeconomic left-right concerns. And it is on these, it is in this area where the anywhere, somewhere distinction is particularly salient. I think, you know, so much else of, kind of standard economic size of the state issues, anywheres and somewheres, I think, can be found on both sides of the argument. The distinction is particularly pertains to sociocultural politics, what one might call the security and identity issues, where these distinctions really matter. What about the politics of all this? The reason why this value division has created a less stable politics. What's been going on? Well, I mean, I think to put it very simply, what has happened in the last generation is that for as long as the older people in this room can remember, British common sense was essentially somewhere common sense. And then at some point in the early 90s, perhaps, mid-90s, and since then, gradually anywhere common sense has effectively replaced it in the political class particularly. And the people that run this country are overwhelmingly anywheres across all the political parties, and they've ruled the country in the anywhere interest, thinking that it's the national interest, as indeed some of the time it probably has been the national interest, but they have ruled the country in the anywhere interest, and they have over-dominated society, economy, and culture. And this, what I would call liberal overreach, has created the backlash that has given us Brexit, it has given us the UKIP breakthrough, and so on. The people with UKIP values, you know, who are, I think, mostly perfectly decent people. Indeed, I talk about the anywheres having an ideology of progressive individualism, and I talk about most somewheres. I mean, there is a more extreme group at the bottom, but most somewheres having a set of views that I call decent populism. Because, of course, throughout the last 30 or 40 years, you've also seen a huge liberalisation of British society, particularly on cultural matters, whether it's race, sexuality, gender. There has been a big liberalisation, and most somewheres have gone along with that. One might say it's been sort of anywhere led, but and somewheres have some reservations about some of it, but broadly speaking, have gone along with it. As I say, I mean, you know, both Nigel Farage, to give perhaps a slightly over-colourful example, both Nigel Farage and Nick Clegg are liberals in any sort of meaningful historic sense. They both believe in the rule of law. They both believe in minority rights, in equality, in the broadest sense. They both believe in checks and balances on power. I mean, all of the things that we would have historically called liberalism, they believe in. Now, they disagree on some of these aspects to do with group attachments and belonging and so on. Where was I? So I think a lot of what we're talking about is a kind of legitimate populist reaction to the over-domination of the agenda by anywhere interest. Now, let me just give you examples of that. I mean, I think, take education. I mean, a decision was made back in the 1990s to go helter-skelter to expand higher education, because the decision was taken by people who'd been to Russell Group universities themselves. Their children were all at Russell Group universities. This is a world they knew and understood and valued, and quite rightly so. Of course, you know, this is not a novel point, but we've seen even more than usual in the post-war period the ignoring of, the downplaying of, the under-resourcing of the other options that children who are not on a university path towards apprenticeships or technical education. 1992, we famously eviscerated our rather prestigious technical institutions, the polytechnics. Why? Because the directors of the polytechnics wanted to become universities, because universities were more prestigious. So they became universities, and they now produce vast amounts of research that I suspect not very many people read. And we no longer have people doing HNDs and HNCs, or in trivial numbers of people. We have 8,000 people signed up for construction apprenticeships last year, and we're meant to be building millions of houses. I mean, we just have got this very wrong. I mean, it's not all the anywhere's fault. There's a historical roots to this, but they have certainly, we have, you know, have exaggerated the problem by putting all our eggs in the university basket. And I think that's because this is the world that the people running the country knew. And you kind of stick with what you know works. And that obviously sort of links in with the broader economic question. You know, we talk about the knowledge economy, an economy that works for people who have a lot of knowledge, who are highly qualified, who are highly educated. And we have seen the evolution of hourglass labour market. So lots of the kind of middle-paid jobs, particularly associated with manufacturing, that used to give somewheres, you know, dignity and status, have declined. We have had much greater openness. I mean, partly going back to the Thatcher-Reagan liberalisation of our economies, we have seen business increasingly sort of disregarding their national obligations, not really feeling that they have national obligations, certainly feeling that any kind of national social contract that may have attached to them has become much weaker. You just have to look at what has happened to training. There's a very important piece of work, never seems to get quoted by anybody. Francis Green at UCL has done some number crunching on the amount of time people spend in training now compared to 20 years ago. It's fallen by nearly a half, I think. The amount of money spent on training has fallen by a third just in the last 20 years. And of course, because we have, you know, particularly since 2004, we have had this huge reserve army of labour at all levels of skill. If you're a British employer, you know, why not take advantage of that? So we've had that. We've had historically unprecedented levels of immigration of all kinds particularly since 1997. This has not been popular. I gave you the figures earlier. I don't think it's mainly xenophobic. There are xenophobic people. I think it is. It's to do with rapid change in certain parts of the country. People always say, "Oh, but the people who are most object to immigration, there aren't any immigrants there." I think that is completely to misunderstand the social psychology of what we're talking about here. The former industrial places that are very depressed, the national story has passed them by, they feel resentful that the national story has passed them by. The national story is now all about, you know, the great urban centres and minorities and, you know, other people who seem to have stories, and their story doesn't exist any longer. They're also affected in other ways by very large-scale immigration. You know, we have a national labour market, so, you know, even if there aren't any people from Eastern Europe in your immediate locality, it may well still affect the wage rates you receive and so on. I mean, just to give you one case, the food manufacturing is our largest manufacturing sector in what is left of our manufacturing industry. Employs about 400,000 people. Until 2004, None of those were from Eastern Europe, or perhaps a few, a dozen. There are now 120,000 people from Eastern Europe who work in the food manufacturing sector. You know, just imagine, you know, if you're, you know, you're working in a fish finger factory in Hull, and suddenly the factory is, you know, half full of people who you probably don't have any personal resentment towards, but, you know, you will feel discombobulated by that kind of change, and I think that is not unreasonable that you do. In fact, I was just talking to an MP, a Norfolk MP, who was telling me that there's this town called Waffham, is it? One of those kind of
Anybody from Swaffham?
No, not Swaffham. It's a kind of town near Swaffham. Okay. It's even more sort of inbred and kind of Norfolk. sorry, I take that back. Anywhere prejudice. Just sheer anywhere prejudice. Very good example of anywhere prejudice. It's a kind of one-horse town that used to have a pig factory. In fact, still does have a pig factory. And you know, it used to provide relatively decent jobs, and there was a kind of working men's club and a nice pool table and all of that. The local family that owned it sold it to a bigger multinational corporation, and you know, and they brought in more kind of modern management methods and didn't feel so connected to the kind of local social contracts, as it were, and. Of the 900 workers in it, 800 of them now come from Eastern Europe, and they live in hostels in King's Lynn, and they send a lot of their money home, and you know, and good for them. But you can see why this is not particularly popular with a large number of people. So you've had the openness issue as well. No one's against openness. I mean, I think this conceit that you know, instead of left and right, it's now open versus closed. Have you ever met anybody who's in favour of a closed society? I haven't. But there are forms of openness that work for different people, and I think a lot of the people that voted Brexit think that the current form of openness has not been working well for them. There are other areas of policy. I mean, I could talk about family policy, for example. I think you've had. You've had a kind of bias against domesticity in family policy. I mean, obviously, there's been a perfectly appropriate stress on equality and autonomy for women, but I think a lot of people feel that you know, traditional roles that are still valued by many people, the male breadwinner, the stay-at-home housewife, that it's actually kind of almost both sort of culturally and economically impossible to enjoy those roles any longer, and that is sort of not fair. You know, we put all our kind of policy baskets, again, a sort of liberal overshoot, into worrying about women on boards. Perfectly good thing. We want more women on boards. Meanwhile, the working class family has disintegrated. And I was astonished. I mean, I didn't really know a huge amount about this area. I have a whole chapter on family policy in the book, and how the Conservative Party has gone along completely with the liberal consensus in this area. So things that would have been considered really quite sort of countercultural 20 years ago are now absolutely mainstream. And I think the Tories felt that in order to sort of get a hearing in British society and to no longer be seen as a nasty party, they had to just sort of completely give in on that. So I think we have a very unbalanced family policy too. And again, if you look at the statistics, more than three quarters of women want the so-called modified male breadwinner model. Essentially, you know, a decent man who can earn decently while you are looking after young kids. You don't want it forever. You want it for a certain period of time. You know, you will need to work yourself. We don't, you know, the idea of the family wage disappeared a long time ago. But you want to focus on family responsibilities when your children are young. That is not an extraordinary thing, but you know, if you look at a public policy in these areas, it is rather extraordinary. So many people want this. They don't want to go back to the 1950s, but they want to, they want a gender division of labour when children are young. We spend £8 billion on childcare every year, and you're not allowed to look after your own child. Lots of other countries have care allowances and things like that. We don't have any of that. In fact, we don't have any tax breaks for families in this country. You're not allowed to share. Well, they brought in a tiny bit of it now, but you're not allowed to share your tax allowances. Partners aren't allowed to share their tax allowances, which seems absolutely crazy. I talk about this in the book. I don't think it should be a marriage thing. I think it should be for people who are living together and bringing up children. So we've had the education story, the economy story, the openness and immigration story, family policy story. I could go on, but perhaps best if I don't. And we've had just a couple more minutes. What are we on? I don't want to be gloomy about this. I do have a chapter in the book called The New Settlement, I think it's probably the weakest part of the book, to be honest. But I think there are areas where I think one can think about bridges, as it were, between the two groups, and how we can narrow this gap that is creating this instability in our politics. But in parenthesis, I think one of the interesting and perhaps rather unfair and sad political stories in here is that this distinction has been particularly damaging to the centre-left across Europe, and in our obviously in our country too. You can sort of see it in the news every day. And I think that is because my value blocks, my value distinctions, are the voter base of the parties of the centre-left. The value distinction runs right down the middle of them, right down the middle of them. All the established parties are obviously affected by this kind of value divide and the energising to populist politics that it has allowed. But I think the centre-left are particularly affected by it because of the way that it's absolutely destroyed what one might have called 40 or 50 years ago the Hampstead-Hartlepool alliance. The alliance of the kind of progressive, often public sector intelligentsia and blue-collar Britain. It's absolutely dead. It used to be that these groups had different priorities. Back in the 80s or the 90s, Hampstead was more concerned about, ending apartheid and gay rights and things like that. Hartlepool was concerned about trade union laws or whatever. They had different priorities. They didn't have different interests. I think now they have different interests. Just think of something like freedom of movement. I talked earlier about the people working in food manufacturing factories. For people from Hampstead, freedom of movement is, of course, a great blessing. You're a lawyer, you can go and work in the Berlin office for a few years, and you're not likely to face... it's true. 26% of British academics are foreign-born, so actually some of you do face some competition, I'm glad to say. Broadly speaking, it's competition that you can deal with, or is it easier for you to deal with? Whereas if you're somewhere, you won't have the skills or possibly the aptitude to want to go and work abroad. There was Albina Zane Pett, but that was a particular period. And you will feel, you will feel that you... this is real in your face, globalization. It's one thing to have your factory closed down and move to China. It is quite another thing for a workforce to be imported to compete with you in your own country. And the party called Labour, which was designed to reduce competition in the labour market, has not squealed about this at all. Ed Miliband made a few kind of vague apologies about opening up the doors 7 years before we had to. But, you know, it is extraordinary. I mean, if I was if I was a former Labour voting somewhere, I would certainly not vote Labour. Labour has become a party for Liberal graduates, essentially. I mean, it's, you know, all the activists are Liberal graduates, most of the MPs are Liberal graduates, and most of the interests that they represent are those of Liberal graduates. It's going to be a long and agonising death, I fear. So, new settlement. I mean, I do think, I think the future of politics, you know, is about how we find a new settlement between these value groups. I think that there is a debate going on. You sort of see it from time to time emerging from the shadows. There is a debate amongst, of course, I mean, anywheres do not think of themselves as anywheres, but there is a debate, I think, going on between, as it were, different wings of the anywhere political class, between those who think that, yes, we really have rather screwed things up here. We haven't been listening, and we really should start listening. We have run things too much in our own interests for the last generation or so. And then there's another group, one might call them the AC Grayling group, who say, absolutely not. You know, we've got to dig down. They are barbarians. We are the civilized ones. And I think it's, you know, the outcome of this argument hangs the future of British politics in some ways. Perhaps I should stop there, actually. I mean, I do have some ideas for a new settlement. It's not complete gloom. I mean, I do think much of the new settlement is about anywheres conceding more to somewhere priorities, respecting, I mean, obviously everything is changed by Brexit anyway. Brexit has been a massive sort of somewhere blow over the head to anywheres. So that in itself readjusts the balance to some extent. It is about, you know, new forms of openness that are not quite as open, and renewing national social contracts in employment. Trying to sort out the kind of technical and the apprenticeship stuff, you know, which actually, to be fair, I mean, this government, governments realised some years ago, actually, and they've been doing a sort of slow handbrake turn on it, that they had gone too far in expanding higher education and needed to think about the other options more. We still haven't done nearly enough on that. We subsidise far more, you know, even with student fees, we subsidise higher education far more than we do the technical and apprenticeship routes, and that is just grossly unfair, particularly given the middle class domination of the higher education route. There are other things that just two very general things where I think anywheres and somewheres there are bridges. I think localism and voice and is one whole area. I actually think somewheres are not interested very much in sort of political forms. Probably relatively few of them voted in our, relatively few of anybody voted in the proportional representation referendum, whenever it was a few years ago. But actually, I think PR would be good for somewhere voice. You know, we would have a UKIP type party in Parliament with 30 seats, and that would be a good thing for our politics, I think. So there's a whole, there are voice issues where actually, you know, Nick Clegg and Nigel Farage might agree for perhaps a slightly different reasons. There's also the whole area of kind of the environment and greenness. At one level, you know, somewheres are not really interested in renewables, and they just sort of think of it as more, you know, higher energy bills and so on. On the other hand, somewheres are very rooted people, and greenness is about rootedness in some ways, about the environment and preserving things. And so I think it's a bit abstract, I grant you, but I think somewhere there is also a bridge. Anyway, I'll stop there. Thank you.
Okay, very good. Thank you, David. I should have said at the beginning, there's a Twitter hashtag.
Hashtag London.
Brexit. Too late now. Well, never mind. Watch
up so they can see it. Can they see
here?
It?
Hashtag LSE Brexit, LSEEI. Part of a wider programme. Don't worry. Now, I just want to kick off the questioning. Do worry, obviously. Tweet away. At the end there, you touched on the idea of localism and, you know, that might be a bridge. The truth is that in addition to all the things you write about in the book, we know, and you do touch on this, Britain is the most centralised, and England within the UK, the most centralised of all democracies. It is spectacularly centralised. So do you think that in a more radically devolved version of England, oblique the UK, it would be possible to allow more of the differences that by implication you say you believe need to be reflected in politics, could then be reflected?
Well, the trouble is they're not really regional differences, are they? Well, I mean, they are to some extent. I mean, there are left behind areas, not just left behind people. There are whole, parts, sure. You know, kind of Yorkshire and Humberside, you know, where these are kind of low, very low social mobility areas. For example, it's Yorkshire and Humberside, parts of Wales. You know, I mean, that are very left behind, but they're usually attached, or you know, they're usually attached to other places that are thriving, or they'll have thriving places within them. You know, Leeds is quite a dynamic place. You've got, I mean, what I do think is true. It's a slightly different point. Is that somewhere interests are better served by small incremental advances often than big symbolic gestures, you know, so much less interested in HS2, much more interested in the kind of infrastructure, transport connections. I mean, I think, you know, the infrastructure problem in Britain can be divided between, in England anyway, can be divided between the south, which is essentially about housing and the lack of it, and the north, which is much more about transport connections. You know, it's only last year or the year before that they reconnected Burnley with Manchester. That there had been no direct rail link between Burnley and Manchester for 45 years or something. And there are all sorts of other examples like that, where you can just spend relatively small amounts of money and you can make it easier for people to come from some of these more depressed, former mining villages or whatever, that are perhaps, you know, 30, 40 miles from these partly these northern cities, partly revived actually by higher education, the Sheffields and Manchesters and Leeds and Newcastles. It's slightly different.
Qualified,
point.
Yes. Okay, right. Now, so let's take two or three questions at a time. Start here, and then we'll do two or three near the front, and then we'll do three or four near the back, or two or three near the back. So, yes,
thanks.
And if you'd like to say who you are, feel free to say who you are, but don't feel you've got to.
Of course, sorry, my name is Alex Gerald. I work for the Bank of New York Mellon. If you look at Scotland, it seems that there is a large, very social identity there. They have a lot of industries. You've got fishing, petrochemicals. You've got finance isn't low skill in that way. Industries that haven't done particularly well through globalization and through, let's be honest, membership of the European Union. You've got a large proportion of the population you would describe as a strong somewhere, I imagine. And yet they've got this curious dogmatic attachment to the European Union, which is traditionally a very anywhere pastime. Is that a slight inversion of your argument, or?
Definitely mentioned in the book. Right, we'll take these two here.
I've got a theory on that one.
All right, good, we'll take two more, and then I'll come to you at the back, I promise.
My name is Adam Somerset. I'm an occasional contributor to the political think tank in Wales, where we do actually have a part proportional representation and a UKIP bloc. First thing they did was depose their leader, and I have to say their contribution to civic political life has not been great. my question was that I haven't read your book. The division last year on the vote in Brexit had a very clear generational divide, old versus young, which would suggest that your particular bifurcation didn't carry across the generations. I was just wondering what your data said. And also I was wondering about the ethics of a polity where essentially the country is directed by the old, with a very limited stake in the future of the country, my generation, as against the young.
Okay, and yeah.
You touched upon employment, Paul McGrail, a Catholic workers group. You touched upon employment. And I'm just wondering if, just taking the sectors like hospitality, food harvesting and processing, the NHS, social care, we all know pretty much the percentages that are these of these jobs which are being, which are employing Eastern Europeans. 3 or 4 years from now, if these jobs are not, your prognosis is, how will you incentivize British nationals to work in hellish kitchens or in social care when they're quite obviously not inclined towards those occupations?
Right.
Okay. Scotland. Scotland is, you know, it illustrates my thesis that, you know, the anywhere somewhere divide has opened up politics to more populist and nationalist sentiments. I mean, the overdomination of the anywhere agenda. The SNP are a nationalist party. I mean, they're an ethnic party. I mean, they have a civic nationalist program and discourse, and I'm not for one moment suggesting they don't believe it, but I think the reasons, I mean, I think that there is quite a big gap on a lot of these questions between the leadership and the rank and file of the SNP. A lot of the rank and file are proper nationalists and voted for Brexit. You know, I mean, a lot of the SNP people voted for Brexit. And there is a very serious sort of paradox, I think, for the leadership, that they are desperate to leave, a union, a historic union that's 300 years old. It's sort of stood the test of time. It's, you know, involves all sorts of intertwining of families, and they want to leave that and subject themselves to a much more distant authority called Brussels, you know, with very strict rules that they're going to have to conform to. I mean, it is. I think they will kind of get found out on that in some way, actually, when it comes to... And also, it's much easier for Scotland to leave the United Kingdom when we're both in the European Union. It is much harder. You know, it is a hard exit for them if they take it. But I think the glues of Britishness are no longer as strong as they were, and there is a historic and, to some extent, understandable and justifiable resentment from... the smaller Celtic countries, I mean, including Ireland, sharing a bed with a giant like England is uncomfortable some of the time for Scotland, Wales, and Ireland, and the belief that England only looks after its own interests. And I think it would have been slightly bizarre. I mean, it's a slightly bizarre expectation, when you read people. You know, about Irish politicians are writing about how sort of selfish the English have been about voting Brexit. Should people have really voted on the kind of intricate politics of the Irish north-south border? I mean, you know, it's a shame if it has mucked it up, but I mean, of course people aren't going to make that the priority. I mean, they might think about it in the course of voting, but of course most people don't know about it anyway. You can see why all of this has happened. And you can see why Brexit, you know, gives Sturgeon another chance. But I think it is, you know, I mean, the SNP I would definitely cite as evidence of the, you know, of a kind of populist nationalist, and partly people in Scotland were very disillusioned with the Labour Party. I think, you know, partly for, you know, we hear the anywhere reasons, you know, the Iraq war or whatever. And actually, you know, opposition to the Iraq war, I think, is a very somewhere thing. I mean, you know, the idea of an ethical foreign policy is, if you just sort of pluck a few ideas from the air. I mean, any foreign policy should be a national foreign policy conducted ethically. I mean, the idea of an ethical foreign policy in itself, an example of the kind of extreme way in which a kind of anywhere self-regard had dominated the political agenda. I mean, mean, you were really making a statement rather than... just remind me what the question was about.
Generational divide.
Oh, the generational thing. Sorry, yeah. But just on your... I'm sure... In fact, I did a programme the other day with a UKIP member of the Welsh Assembly. And I see what you mean. But... This is about turning trolls into politicians. You know, in another few years, they get civilized. I mean, I think this is a story right across Europe too. I think it's, there is monstrous populism and there is decent populism and possibly various points in between. I mean, clearly Wilders is at the extreme end. I think UKIP, is broadly speaking a form of decent populism. But these are also people who are, who've come mainly from outside the political system.
Neil Hamilton. Sorry to interrupt.
Neil
Hamilton has not come from the outside.
No, that's true. I mean, there are one or two retreads. Yeah, but I mean, I think people often say this about, that some words are just going to die out, aren't they? I mean, this is what David Aronovich is praying for. He's always writing about, somewhere barbarians dying out. I'm afraid the truth is they are not going to die out. They may shrink a bit more in number, or the anywheres may grow a little bit more in number, but I think a lot of these things are actually pretty... I think we've got to a point where it won't actually change that much. You're seeing evidence that younger generations, Generation Z or whatever the name is, they're actually more conservative than ever before on lots of issues. A lot of it is a life cycle thing too. I mean, when you're kind of young and unattached, you're a student, you live in a big city, you have the kind of priorities and values that go along with that. Then you settle down, you have a family, you become a slightly different kind of person. And, you realize the value of stability and tradition and things that you used to treat with contempt. So I think there's a life cycle, and I think there is that. There will always be, I think, a big body of people who put security and stability before novelty and innovation. Look at all of human history, and I think a lot of people just want a quiet life and to sort of be steady and. Of course, lots of anywheres want a quiet life too, in a different way. But I think anyway, was there a oh, oh the employment? Well, I think no. I mean, I disagree. The idea that you didn't say this, I know, but a lot of people say the British working class are so bloody lazy. We've got to bring in all the Latvians to do the work. Absolute nonsense. If people, we have a welfare state. People have got used to having options in this country, and presumably most of us in this room think that that's quite a good thing. So people don't take the first job, particularly if it's a minimum wage job. I mean, remember the oil rigs? People used to were happy to do the most antisocial, go off for 3 months, leave your family. People were prepared to work on the oil rigs because it paid bloody well. People will do mucky, antisocial, but they won't do back-breaking labour in a Norfolk farmer's field for the minimum wage. Now, if you come from the Ukraine or even Bulgaria or Romania, what you're getting paid is kind of like the oil rigs was to our working class blokes 20 years ago. So, of course, you want to do it. But you're comparing like with unlike. It's unfair competition. We're a high-wage economy with a welfare state. You bring in people for whom this is... And also, they're often the most kind of enterprising, dynamic people in these societies who are competing against many of the least enterprising and least dynamic people in our society. But we have a national social contract, don't we? We're a society, so we have some obligations to those people.
But you're going to have to force those people to take those jobs.
No, you're not going to have to force them to take those jobs. Oh, look, we're not expelling all the East Europeans. I mean, all that's going to happen... In fact, in high skill areas, I don't expect there to be very much change. There'll be some sort of fast-track system. You want to bring in your academics, it'll be fine. And you don't have to... you do not have to comply with the resident labour market test. You never have done in universities, actually. It's a curious thing. You have this privilege of not having to do a resident labour market test. For high skill, I think we'll see relatively little change. For kind of medium and lower skill jobs, it is true we have become over-dependent on people, you know, hardworking people from poorer countries in Europe have come here, and we've become very dependent on them in some areas, like I was saying earlier, food manufacturing, hospitality. I mean, I'm not so, you know, I mean, I think in some of these areas, we, you know, the objective surely will be to bring down the numbers of immigrants from poorer European countries through, you know, and, you know, employers. I mean, they're already saying this in, you see it in the FT, in the kind of horticulture sector. They're saying, oh my God, you know what? We're going to have to pay higher wages. Oh my God. You know, I mean, a lot of them can pay higher wages. And, you know, if they don't have to, they're not going to. I mean, you know, social care, there are quite a few there aren't that many Eastern Europeans in social care. There are a few, particularly in London and South East, much less in the rest of the country. We need to sort that out anyway. I mean, pay in social care is abysmal. It's going to be a mixture of government and employers, and the fact that there will still be people who will want to come and work here. And we're only talking, don't forget, about the kind of marginal new employee. I mean, the existing, some of the existing employees may go, perhaps partly because their wages don't go as far as they used to because of the drop in the pound. But I don't think that it needs to be a disaster.
Right. Go to the back for some questions, right? Yes, one. Gentleman at the back, and I'll take two here, and I'll come over to you later over there. So. Yep. No, sorry. Yes.
So you're talking about mass immigration and how that's, you know, the influx of Eastern European people taking jobs, etc. What about the rise of technology in terms of a lot of roles and jobs in the future? I think we're seeing it already. Technology is kind of taking that over as well. So what's going to happen when there comes a point when even we don't need or the Eastern Europeans who are coming into the country, they don't have a job either. How will technology, essentially its rise, affect this kind of populist movement, and how will politics have to sort of react to that?
Okay, and right at the back, and then we'll come across to the middle there, yeah.
Just to return to the main theme in the book, populism, what is the source of populism? In my view, it's the misunderstanding of terminal values like freedom, justice, sovereignty, which was so much discussed during the Brexit. But there is another thing that relates directly to the discussion here today. It's the minorities, why minorities have not been represented in our parliament, for the reason that we have an electoral system that doesn't promote minorities. We have somehow come to the conclusion that a strong government have to defy the rights to be represented of those who say do not like UKIP, for instance. I'm not UKIP supporter, has only one mandate. And the link to that is the question of devolution. Who is the central government to say to Scotland, Wales, or even London that they cannot have their own statehood, that Catalonia or Basque country cannot form their own states? This is the basic philosophical argument of what freedom means, and therefore a freedom to associate in the groups that are capable of being considered as states on the international scene.
And then, yeah, there's a hand, right, gentleman right in the middle there, if you can hand it across. I'll come back.
As an anywhere Remainer of about the same age as you, I find a lot that is familiar and persuasive in what you say. But I do wonder that if your thesis is designed to try and explain what the result of the referendum, you may be playing down inappropriately some of the pure economic factors, as I would call them. In particular, the near stagnation of living standards since 2008 for the median person in the population. Are you not, by focusing on value divisions, undervaluing or downplaying too much purely economic factors?
Right.
Okay. I don't really know about technology. None of us really know about technology. I mean, I'm a kind of optimist. I mean, people are always worrying that jobs are going to be, you know, ever since the internal combustion engine replaced the horse, you know, we've worried about this. And I can't see any particular reason why it should be any different this time. you know, we now all have computers, and that's created a massive industry of people looking after our computers. I wish someone would look after mine. But, I mean, I do think, I mean, if what you say is partly true, and that somehow it is different this time, I think it's probably more anywhere professional jobs that are going to be adversely affected. You know, you don't have to listen to Tony. You can just, you know, you can read a text by him online. I mean, you know, the rise of the online university and you know, lawyers and chartered accountants and everything being sort of digitalised. And so, I mean, I think that in that sense, it's sort of grist to my mill slightly. I mean, so anywhere people are going to have more a more kind of somewhere experience of being done to, you know, they're going to march through the world less confidently. On the gentleman at the back, I mean, the kind of the academic definition of populism tends to be a belief on the part of populists that the people have a single and definable interest that is against the interests of the elite. I mean, that's sort of crudely what people talk about. What's that?
Six. Sorry, just...
No, that's not true. sorry, the point about sovereignty is an important one, and actually this is you've reminded me of a footnote that I left out, which is that I think this is one of the reasons, I mean, you know, control of immigration is obviously a sovereignty issue, and, you know, I think it was particularly... You know, when we had this, you know, when 2004 happened, we had, you know, 1.5 million people coming in a period of 3 or 4 years when we were expecting 15,000 a year or whatever. And the fact that Parliament wasn't able to do anything about it, I think it kind of woke people up actually to the fact that there really had been a very large transfer of sovereignty. I mean, you know, back in the post-colonial immigration experience. There's obviously friction and racism and discrimination and so on, but, you know, by the 80s and 90s, we'd sort of partly come through that story and moved on. One of the reasons was that the numbers came down. One of the kind of one of the little known aspects of Thatcherism was bringing down numbers, so that by the early 90s we had negative net immigration into Britain. You know, because we had a sovereign parliament still that was able to do that. 2004, you know, I mean, on this pretty, you know, these pretty existential questions of, you know, who comes to live in the country, we weren't able to. Not only that, but also, you've had a huge increase in sort of the technocratic dilution of democratic control. You know, you look everywhere. The Migration Advisory Committee is now being proposed as, you know, they should be telling the politicians, you know, how many workers we want in each sector. You've got the independence of the Bank of England. You've got the Human Rights Act and judicial activism. Now, all of these kind of sort of technocratic erosions, you might say, of a more straightforward parliament-based democratic sovereignty. You know, who is making decisions in all these places? I tell you, it's not somewheres. You know, technocracy equals another form of anywhere power. I didn't quite get your point about minorities in the electoral system. Right. So they think so. Parties assume the electorate are racist, and therefore they don't appoint minority candidates. Well, there's possibly a little bit of truth in that in some places. I don't think on the whole it is true any longer. We've had a pretty consistent rise in the minority, the proportion of minorities in Parliament, I think, is now about 5 or 6%, which is significantly less still than the proportion of minorities in the population. But when you think, you know, nearly half of the minority population are immigrants. So, you know, and many of them, you know, will not be, you know, acculturated into British society. So, you know, it's not surprising. The number will rise, and is rising pretty sharply. Is it all an economic thing? I don't think so. I mean, economics is not irrelevant. And the fact that we've had this, we've had the post-2008 stagnation, income stagnation, and it is another reason for feeling mistrustful towards the people that run the country. Like I say, I mean, all the parties are dominated by more or less liberal graduates who have the priorities of liberal graduates, and I explained in some of the areas. So there's a kind of alien, there's a sort of base alien. I mean, 93% of people in Parliament are graduates. And a much larger proportion of the population do go to university, so it's not, there are lots of people to whom it's not particularly alienating, but there are lots of people, I think, to whom it is. There are people from a different world. Whatever their social background, like I said, you're removed from wherever you live and you travel 150 miles or whatever to go to a residential university. There's the London domination British life, so you may well, if you've got a successful career, you might come to London. You join a kind of group that is actually, I think it's true to say, I looked for evidence for this and couldn't really find any, but I think a lot of, particularly people who go to Russell Group universities, on the whole, will have very few non-graduate close friends. It's not an apartheid system, but, there is a genuine separation of lives, wherever you started from. And I think it's, that contributes to this sort of alienation from the people that are running the society. And then you have, you add on the economics that you were talking about, you add on the Iraq war, you add on the expenses scandal, and it all, it all feeds into that possibly over dramatic disillusionment with. Of course, people have always been sort of disillusioned by their political masters. It's hardly a new story, but I do think it's, I think much more of this is a non-material thing. It is about people feeling not valued, particularly somewhere people feeling not valued, not having a place in a society run by people, in the interests of people with high cognitive ability.
David, do you think, given that there is clearly a logical challenge to move to a more representative parliament, do you think that, and given that the EU referendum allowed every vote in the UK to be weighed equally, which is very unusual, not just for that reason, but because of safe constituencies, which reinforces some of this. Do you think that a greater use of referendums would be a help?
I'm anti-referendum. I don't think it was a good. The working class stopped voting, basically. The reason for Brexit is that people who had not voted for six elections turned up to vote. I'm not against that, but I want them to vote every election so that we don't have to, because the anywhere dominated political class senses that it's kind of alienated from mainstream opinion on a lot of things. So that the way they get around that is by calling referendums. But actually, it'd be much better if we had a political agenda that did not exclude a large proportion of the population, and people joined political parties again, or that may be going a bit too far, but at least voted again. And then we wouldn't have these kind of these swings.
Are you arguing for PR here?
Yeah, I argued for it earlier. I think So it'd be good to have a populist party in Parliament with 30 or 40 seats.
Okay, right. The middle of the audience now deserves attention. So 1, 2, 3. Let's do 4 this time. So I don't know what in the very middle here. Yeah, wave your hand. Long.
He's going to give me a hard time, that guy.
Is he? Yeah, all right.
Man with glasses, yeah.
Go on. Man with glasses is going to give him a hard time. Go for it if you want. Yeah. Or not.
My name's Richard Kulczycki. I'm basically caring for my mother these days. It's very interesting what you said. I've got lots of possible questions, but I'll just stick to this. I mean, you're basically talking to us about values and diagnosis, and you're talking about different values that different that aren't represented now. But it's making it clear that it's really shocking that our politicians are not able to articulate these ideas and bring them out and present them to us. What can you see? How can you see that changing? Surely it needs to change. I mean, the country's going to go through a very hard time with Brexit, living standards falling. The big corporations are going to come after BP and Vodafone, AT&T and Exxon are going to come after BP. There's going to be lots of problems. But how can you see this changing now? And one quick comment, you said some ways won't go away, and I think that's really definitely true, because I think a lot of migrants are actually going to be somewheres as well.
Yeah.
Right, now, just behind, can you pass it two back, and then that gentleman that's right, to there, and then you can pass it two to your right. No, use it, you speak.
I get to speak. Okay, fine.
You just to hand it around.
I'm going to try to give you a slightly hard time. I want to talk about your example of the fish finger factory, because I doubt that there was ever a time that working in a fish finger factory wasn't a bloody awful job with really awful wages. And I suspect that now we have a minimum wage, thanks to the well-known villain Tony Blair, that is probably better paid than it was in the past. So I think is there a slight danger that you're rewriting a non-existent past? And secondly, leading on from that, what happens if there are... is a smaller pool of migrant labour for that fish finger factory, is it not one of two things? Either there aren't enough workers and the factory leaves and actually relocates to Poland or to wherever, or alternatively, that the factory stays, it might have to pay higher wages, and then the prices of its fish fingers go up, it's no longer competitive and it goes bankrupt. So don't we really need to tell people the truth and make it really clear that there is no kind of nirvana that you achieve by removing EU workers? I should declare an interest in that I work for the European Commission, so I'm definitely an anywhere. although I would say that both of my grandfathers were unskilled workers, and I know what their life was like, and it was bloody awful. So.
And can you pass it to left, two to your left? To the chap. Sorry, it's your right. It's God. I hope you see what it's like in a car, can't you? Or indeed in politics, you might argue. Anyway, go on.
I wanted to go a bit further into something which you just touched on in one of your previous answers. I have to say I found what you said quite persuasive in terms of being an explanatory system for the kind of changes that we're seeing at the moment. I'm interested in whether you think, and this links into kind of building a new settlement, whether you think the somewhere anywhere divide, the deep divide that we're seeing at the moment is inevitable, and what role kind of socialization plays in that. Certainly as an anywhere, since all the kind of Brexit stuff started, I have noticed that I am hopelessly isolated from, I don't know what you'd call it, the real world of the UK, since I went to university 8 years ago, each time I go home, I'm still in touch with a few people who I went to school with who didn't go to university. Each time I go home, what we're thinking about and our ideas and our values are more and more different each time. And so I wonder if you think that there we need to be, I don't know, mixing more.
The guy with the glasses who didn't give me a hard time. I think what you said made me think that, one shouldn't... I mean, I do think we have had a dramatic over-domination, as I've said many times, of politics and the policy agenda by anywhere interests. But you might well say, well, hang on a sec, the two largest selling national newspapers, The Sun, The Daily Mail, I mean, there is quite a strong populist voice out there, and I think that is true. But look at the areas of public life where somewhere interests until the Brexit referendum, have kind of defeated anywhere interests. They're a much smaller minority or a much smaller group in some ways. I mean, I can think of two. You might be able to help me with others. One not particularly attractive one. I think most somewheres tend to be pretty draconian when it comes to criminal justice, so you might attribute our overflowing prisons to somewhere values and interests. You might also attribute the welfare cap. They tend to be pretty, somewheres, rightly, I think, you know, would like a much more contributory welfare system than the more kind of universalist welfare system that we have. But I think the welfare cap can probably be put down to kind of, you know, male, son, somewhere intuitions. I struggle, actually, to get much beyond that. And I mean, I can give you a list as long as my arm on anywhere policies. I talked about some earlier. I could talk about others. A very interesting point about, you know, where do minorities, not so much migrants, minorities fit into this story? And I think it is a rather ignorant liberal illusion. Jeremy Cliff, the Economist writer, wrote that paper just after the 2015 election, which you might have, you know, if you look at the numbers, you might think this is actually a bit of a victory for social conservatism, or for you know, perhaps a slightly more socially conservative anywhere government. I mean, the Conservatives and UKIP between them got what? 58% of the vote or something. Jeremy Cliff came out with this, I think, very naive paper saying, don't worry, you know, the future is all like London, Londonisation, marvellous, marvellous. You know, higher education is going to go on expanding. Look, the minority population is growing very fast. For a start, higher education is not going to go on growing. It's already grown too large, and I think people are beginning to realise that. The minority population, although I think, you know, at one level kind of associated with sort of anywhere openness. I mean, you know, many people would not be here if it hadn't been for the relative openness of British society and people from minority backgrounds, you know, often have different traditions and, you know, do not sign up uncritically to British history, say. But they are overwhelmingly socially conservative. Obviously not all of them, and different, you know, different traditions, but particularly people from more traditional, I mean, you know, British Pakistanis, British Bangladeshis, Somalis, you know, very, very traditional when it comes to family values and so on. True also, I think, to some extent of British Hindus, British Sikhs, some black Africans. There's been more integration between the African Caribbeans and the white population in terms of marriage and partnership, but I mean, those other groups have very different views, actually, to kind of, you know, to liberal modern Britain, and they're tugging Britain in a more religious and a more somewhere socially conservative direction, which I think is a good thing. I think we're going to kind of meet somewhere. I mean, I think there is a problem with some of the very much more traditional views in the Muslim community. But I think you're seeing, you know, younger Muslim women particularly are kind of adjusting to the more sort of the greater gender egalitarianism of normal British life. While I think there may be some movement, you know, to see that actually, you know, that respecting the family and looking after your parents and all those sorts of things are actually things that you know, or the white British population should do more. I mean, I hope to see a kind of meeting in the middle there. Food factories, that I'm sure we're both experts on. What I'd say to you really is, just go back to before 2004. I mean, we didn't have any East Europeans here. Now you're suggesting that the economy is going to fall apart if we don't have, you know, if we don't continue to draw them in the proportions that we currently have. I think the employers have had a free pass on this. I really do. You know, we have had. This has been part of a wider movement. It's not. I mean, I don't blame the European Union alone for this, but there's been a huge shift from labour to capital in the last generation or so. I think freedom of movement has contributed to it. Certainly, from the point of view of British employers, like I gave you the figures about training. An absolute scandal how little British employers train, and they are going to have to. We live in a relatively free economy, but governments can use sticks and carrots. I suspect that, you know, after we've... food manufacturing is a bit of a special case, too, because you do actually need to be quite close to the consumer, or at least for certain bits of it. So importing, you know, obviously you can import your fish fingers, but it's kind of easier to do it here. I mean, what we will see more of, I think we will see wages rising a bit. I think we will see a lot more automation. But why do we have such low productivity in Britain? You cannot tell me it isn't partly because of the great reserve army of labour in Europe, which means that there's been no incentive to invest. I mean, you know, large-scale immigration brings many benefits, but it also reinforces some of the worst habits in British business and the British economy, not investing and not training, to take people off the shelf, and a certain kind of ruthlessness, actually, about British employers too, which I don't think you see so much in parts of continental Europe. Part of our kind of historic liberalism, you might say, that they, and our historic stability, that, you know, we could have we could have great social experiments like Thatcherism here in a way that they would never have dared to do in Germany. You know, Hitler was elected only 40 years before or whatever. But, you know, we have, thanks to our, partly thanks to our island status, we've had this great unbroken continuity of liberal constitutionalism and relative stability. I mean, perhaps there was nearly a revolution in Chartist times, but how did I get there? How did I get to Chartism?
Socialisation and the divides. Let me just take more question. Right.
I do think that this, I mean, someone should write a book. I mean, I do think Brexit is the last great act of the British working class, actually. I think one could write a kind of from Chartism to Brexit. You know, they're kind of disappearing beneath the waves, but this is their last sort of, you know.
Socialisation, going home in the, you know, the divide, is it, you know, meeting people who
share
your views?
Well, I mean, I mean, what you said is sort of grist to my mill in a way. I mean, what you said, I mean, I've experienced it in some ways too, although it was a long time ago. And I think, yeah, I think we should get out and mix more. And I think, you know, anywhere people like us, I think, have had things very much our own way, and we've dominated the kind of the story in this country. And I think a lot of people who have not had our experiences have sort of felt resentful towards it. And I think, you know, our valuation of people has become so narrow. And, you know, like I say, based around, you know, educational qualifications. Now, it's true, you know, that, cognitive ability and educational qualifications are kind of meritocratic. You know, we're all, anyways, are ferocious meritocrats because it's in our interest to be ferocious meritocrats. The only things that can hold us back are prejudice and protectionism. So, of course, we are sort of, it's not a generous liberalism, it's a self-interested liberalism. We have a massive self-interest in it. But I think equally, we are, you know, I mean, it wasn't that long ago when, I mean, I'm exaggerating slightly, obviously, but, you know, valuing experience and character and those sorts of things. I mean, you know, in the Victorian, you know, of course, we laugh about it now, you know, the Victorians going on about character. Well, actually, character, in some ways, it's a more democratic thing to be judged by your character than by how bloody good you are at passing exams.
Right, we're going to take one. Well, we've only got time for one more. All right, two. Gentleman there, lady on the front.
The silver-haired lady at the back as well.
Oh, all right, three then. Sorry, I'm not anything against you. Right, very, very quickly.
Oh, I'm that bloke there. He's been nodding.
Enough. Come on. Right.
Where's it going?
Lady there, gentleman there, lady here. yes, so. Short and sharp, then.
Very quickly, Lynn, just you make very careful points. Okay, you make very careful points trying to understand the somewhere position from the anywhere view. And I'm just wondering, making so many logical views, why did you not vote Brexit yourself?
Okay. That's a good short question, right? That's two. Lady at the back and then the gentleman.
Can I just ask you, Vesna Popovsky, UCL, can I just ask you a question in relation to migration? The issue is, if you look at the research, people who have been coming to this country from 27 countries contribute much more to the exchequer than actually British population. The only group which does not contribute to the exchequer as a British white class population are Pakistanis. So can you explain to me, in your opinion, why migration is suddenly such an important issue?
Okay, and now the gentleman who caught my eye, who really deserves it, because he was the one who caught my eye, go on.
York Erica, software engineer. The question really is this not really actually part of a global revolution, really? I mean, you see the Rohingya being attacked, and there's sort of identity politics there. Modi and Indian nationalism. This is, you know, of course, Trump, and there's, you know, now possibilities of Mexican nationalism and so on as a consequence of Trump. To do with also globalization and the transfer of free movement of capital, for instance, buying off plan in London and completely outside. So a normal house that would have cost 20 years ago, you know, been affordable for a lecturer at the LSE, is now completely actually beyond the, or even a junior doctor or a consultant. And this is actually a global revolution, got the umbrella revolution in Hong Kong, etc.
Okay, right. Three questions.
Okay. Why did I not vote? I was a reluctant Remain. I think because I thought that we could, we could have our cake and eat it too. And I actually don't think that there's going to be a huge change. We were always a semi-detached member of the European Union, and I think we could have gone on being perhaps even a slightly more semi-detached member of the European Union. I think it's such a shame that we didn't. And I think it's actually evidence of us ceasing to think strategically as a country sometime in the 1980s or the 1990s. We kind of, when the Second World War generation died out, you know, people who had been used to running an empire, you have to think strategically about your interests. So you don't necessarily pursue your own short-term interests. You're thinking bigger than that. That kind of thinking disappeared, and it was so called for. Particularly in the 90s, when it was clear that we were going to have an absolutely crazily large euro, a political rather than an economic euro. I mean, already by, I don't know, 97, 98, it was pretty clear what a disaster the euro was going to be. We should have been thinking about being the leader of the outer tier of the European Union. I mean, obviously, those countries were not going to be in the euro, but we had a lot more in common with, we had things in common, not just the non-membership of the euro with the Scandinavians and actually with the East Europeans too. I mean, both in our kind of assumptions about economies, our geopolitics, and so on. And we had a huge amount of goodwill, particularly in Eastern Europe, because we'd been one of the people, countries pushing hardest for enlargement. And we kind of blew it. You know, because we acted in our own narrow, short-term national interest on things. A whole range of issues, I can't remember what they are now, but to do with energy and other things like that, where we really screwed over the Poles, or really, you know, we were on the other side. So it's not surprising. I mean, perhaps it was inevitable that the Poles anyway would get in bed with the Germans. I mean, you know, they are next door, you know, they are kind of, you know, Ireland to Germany's Britain. And the historical rapprochement and all that, perhaps it was inevitable, but I still think it was a great shame, and that we should have done that, and maybe in some funny kind of way we still can do that. Not necessarily, you know, we've probably got to leave first and then not exactly rejoin, but, you know, the thing will have its concentric circles, I think. No, I think, I mean, what... Yeah, no, I mean, I thought we could have got the best of both worlds, that we could have had a slightly looser relationship, so we could have controlled immigration, say, we could have... I mean, the European Union, and indeed, I mean, you know, the global arrangements associated with the WTO, they are incredibly intrusive in a way, you know. I didn't really realise until I sat down and kind of looked at how these things work. We have... I mean, in the interests of wealth, we have hugely sacrificed sovereignty, both on a global scale and even more so with a greater intensity in the European Union. Governments can't just, you know, subsidise a factory and prevent it closing or do this or do that. And there's a kind of uniformity that is that I think is sort of, you know, is destructive to human flourishing in many ways. And I would certainly not have wanted to stay in the European Union as it was, but I think we could have, you know, I mean, perhaps it was my inherent conservatism. You know, I thought it was a bit frightening. When I heard that we'd voted to leave, I was actually, you know, why not? Yeah, it's rather exciting. Good for them. I mean, anyone here, anyone who voted Brexit here? Oh, well, that's quite a lot for the LSE. Well done. Well, anyway, good guys. I didn't have your courage.
What about the 27, the ladies' 27 point and the
gentleman? Oh, well, I mean, I'm sorry to disagree with you, but actually that's just wrong. I mean, Michael Gove is right about experts. The story is, it's a quite complicated one. The people that we really want, I mean, this isn't a money game, or it's not only a money game, but if you look at the fiscal story, there are so many other stories. You know, there are cultural stories, there are rapid change stories, you know. But I think for people in the bottom half or bottom third of the income spectrum, it has not been, large-scale immigration has not been an economic advantage. And then there's the pressure on resources, on infrastructure and so on. And also, just on the fiscal contribution thing, the people that we really want are lots of French and German bankers. They're the, you know, the kind of rich Western European professionals. They're the people who, you know, obviously we don't pay for their education. They come here in their 20s or 30s. They probably leave before they go doddery. So, you know, we get, you know, they work in the city. They get paid 150 grand a year. You know, we get massive tax from them. I'm afraid the East Europeans more or less neutral, because they, you know, even though they tend to be quite highly educated and doing, as you know, doing jobs that are way below their level of education, they don't get paid very well. So they don't, you know, and quite a lot of the money they send home anyway. So they don't actually, I mean, it may be marginally positive, but it's not significantly so. There was a final.
I
point
with
about
global.
About global. Yeah, Putin, Erdogan, yes. Trump, yes. Modi, you know, all of these people are unpopular. You know, Putin is unpopular amongst the Petersburg intelligentsia, but he's very, very popular in the sticks. Same with Erdogan, I'm sure, is unpopular in the fancier parts of Istanbul, but very popular out in the sticks. Modi, I don't really know anything about India, I think there has been a global movement to sort of just slow things down. Actually, to, you know, we've had and I think we're readjusting globalization. I think that's a good thing. You're seeing much less. I mean, financial globalization, particularly flows of capital. They're still there. You know, we're not. You know, God help us. I mean, I hope we don't go back to kind of 1930s trade wars, but we are, you know, we are just restricting things a bit more in response to, you know, you might say the democratic process is kind of working, and you know, Trump is a kind of uglier manifestation of that. Trumpism, I mean, it may be quite interesting. I mean,
hold on. No, let's not refight the. Oh. No, let's not refight the. No, it's not, because in fairness, he voted the other way.
Yeah,
David, just finish that.
You haven't
point.
Been paying attention. but the I mean, America is starting to reindustrialize on quite a large scale. You know, the idea that this is impossible. All of these trends. You know, this is a anywhere ploy. Trends are inevitable and unstoppable and unreversible. I don't know, everything from, you know, Ireland will be united to, well, actually, maybe. But, you know, all of these, they're not. You know, globalization is not an unstoppable thing. Mass immigration is not an unstoppable thing. I'm not saying we want to stop these things completely, but they can be modified and adapted. We live in democracies. And I think, actually, quite a lot of this has alerted, kind of, you know, the anywhere, complacent anywhere, as to the fact that, you know, the democratic voice is unhappy about a lot of things, so they better change it, and they are. I mean, you know, the American reindustrialization is a fascinating story. I mean, it's partly because of energy costs, because of shale gas. Energy costs in America are a third of energy costs here for businesses, and a lot of businesses flooding back. But the same thing could happen here in a couple of years if the Greens don't stop it. We could have lots of lovely shale gas, and our costs could come down, and then we might.
Let's leave that for another night. I'm very happy to do shale gas on another. We need to stop, partly because I just want to say very briefly, and so thank you, David. Just in summarising, we've heard a lot of, there's been a lot of fascinating talk from David, a lot of interesting comments from the floor. We've heard about values, identity, geography, globalisation, lack of representation. And all I'd say is this, that, listening to especially the question about solidarity at the end, I'm struck by the fact that if you look at the polling, there's one thing actually, if you look at, these... the anywheres and the somewheres, they do have quite a lot of things in common. One thing they definitely all believe in, well, not all, but overwhelmingly on both sides of that divide, would be the underlying problem that the British state faces nothing to do with this evening, which is wanting a bigger state than we're prepared to tax for. Okay? That's something they really all agree on, that we want Sweden's public services with America's tax levels. And in delivering that, it's a cliche, but it's a good one. In delivering that, it does seem to me there is the risk to politics in Britain is if they don't resolve all of the things we've discussed tonight, and that, where the anywheres and the somewheres agree with each other, is how you have a bigger state than you'll pay for, then the risk to the government is if they don't deliver, because the public will have a view on that. And the government's now signed up to, it seems to me, a very large number of things, which this book effectively highlights a significant number of them, and the government's now got to sort it out. That's what we believe in. But anyway, I'd like to thank David. I'd like to do two further things. One is to say that the book is on sale outside, and the kindly publisher who was with us this night said, would I mind saying it's 25% off today? Did I get the percentage right?
25%.
Right, 25, made up a new percentage, right. Well, so we do believe in experts and statistics occasionally. Then, anyway, ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to thank David very much.